Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We are live right now and then you can catch it later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need, fast and focused. It's Thursday, the 12th of September. Coming up on the program, the city of Johannesburg responds to claims that its art collection housed at the Johannesburg Art Gallery is at risk of being destroyed. Africa's great East-West support debate and the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants concerned about the low CA pass rate. Last week, you might recall, I had a conversation with Eben Kuhn of the Friends of the Johannesburg Art Gallery, the organization raising concern about the way in which an extensive collection of priceless artworks are being kept at the gallery. That organization, alongside the Johannesburg Heritage Foundation, have now enlisted the help of a legal firm to get the city to take urgent steps to protect the important collection. Before we talk to the Director of Arts and Culture at the city, let's hear once again from Eben Kuhn.
Over the last decade, what we've seen is botched reparations to the building that leads to losing a wing of the building at a time. And it's a marvelous, exquisite collection that is so big, and it's always been too big for the building. You've got a city of people that is extremely proud of this collection, and through various trusts and individuals continue to add to this collection. But the collection simply cannot be stored in the current building any longer. We've got all the financial means to move the collection temporarily to a place of safety, which would fall under the national government, in order for it to be stabilized, that is, restored, digitized, evaluated. That's the first part of our demand to the city. And the second part of our demand to the city is that we believe that it's time to relook the governance structure of this organization, or in order to uphold this institution, to form something like a multi-stakeholder partnership. So we've got lots of cultural agencies, we've got corporates willing to help fund the future of JAG, but the institution at the moment is not successful and isn't sustainable because of how it sits in the city's governance structure. This collection belongs to the people of the city of Joburg. It was left in 1908 to all of us. It's our collection. And it's left in the custody of the city under very specific conditions, which includes that the mayor is meant to chair a specific committee that looks at the art gallery and its well-being. That hasn't been the case for the last two decades at least, and so we're saying that it is really time that we need to force the hand of the city to make the right decisions in terms of the governance of this institution as well as safeguarding the collection.
Well, we'll certainly be putting a phone call through to the mayor's office. You have 9,000 artworks right now improperly stored. The rainy season is upon us. What's the plan?
The plan is that we want to move it as soon as possible to this national facility.
But that's the question I'm asking you.
Some of those will get destroyed because we know that the moment the rainy season starts, water seeps into the building and the staff at JAG literally has to move things around. That's what they've been doing for the last 2 years. The city called all stakeholders 2 years ago and told us that they understand the urgency, but nothing's happened for 2 years.
So, is there a plan as far as the city is concerned? Joining us on the program now is Vuyosile Umshudulu, who is the Director of Arts and Culture at the City of Johannesburg. A very warm welcome to you. So, what's the situation here, and do you have a plan as far as the artwork is concerned?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and good afternoon to the listeners of MoneyWeb. I think we must answer your question directly. There are challenges at the JAG. However, we must also emphasize that the challenges are not as gravely exaggerated as they are by the Friends of the JAG that you've interviewed last year through the spokesperson, Eben Kuhn.
And that, so what exactly also, are these challenges that you refer to, and are artworks that are housed at the Johannesburg Art Gallery in the moment in any sort of danger?
Okay. I think to understand the challenges of the JAG, one first has to have an appreciation of the genesis of the building. The JAG building has got three components linked to it. And the first component of the building was completed, known as the Lutyens building, after the design by Lutyens. Edward Lutyens, the architect at the time, was opened in 1917, and that became the main building. But then, due to the growth of the collection, in the 1940s, there was a realization that the building was too small to house the collection, given the rate at which the collection was growing. And then Howden then did an interpretation of Lutyens' initial designs, and an extension was then built onto the JAG in the 1940s. I think about 1943. And later on then, there was in 1987, another addition to the building called the Meyer Pinar addition, which was designed by the Meyer Pinar firm of architects at that time. And the reports that we got was that there were design flaws with the roof of the Meyer Pinar addition. Since 1987, it has been leaking. Right. Since it was opened.
Right. And Mr. Mshudulu, nothing in that respect has been done. And with the greatest of respect, I appreciate the context, but I need you to answer the question. There is a sense
that the city is reluctant to...
I understand that, but there is a sense that the city is reluctant or slow to take urgent steps to protect the valuable collection. Is that true? And what are you doing?
Well, the assertion that nothing has been done is completely false. And I'm trying to also explain to you that one of the things that this we've done in the city was to establish that the Meyer Pinar, which is where the bulk of the challenges in terms of the roof leaks have been, was completely redesigned by the city. And this was following the resolution by the city to do a full audit of the building. To understand exactly what the source of the problem is, instead of just fixing the problem without really addressing the source. And once that has been done, we realize that there have been many other challenges within the building itself. And a complete a building assessment was conducted. A report was generated. And then there were several areas of high importance that were identified. One of those areas was the fire safety of the building. And that was then prioritized as a matter of urgency by the city. And that was done and completed. And then there was also an issue with the electricals of the building. And you would appreciate, given the size of the building, that would be quite a big task. And the city also did that. But then there was also the need, after the redesign of the Meyer Pinar link of the roof, to do then remedial work, and but also to do the waterproofing in the other sections of the building. And given the scope of that work and the amount of construction it will require, we as the city found that it would not be prudent to do that whilst the collection was still in the building. And it is for that reason that we have been engaging with the Johannesburg Heritage Foundation and the Friends of the JAG to look for alternative sites to house the collection. And we have, along with them, visited several buildings that could have been potential sites where the collection was going to be
and
held.
My question to you is, why has nothing been done? Because nonprofits and corporates have offered to assist in moving the collection at no cost to the city. Why are you not taking advantage of this offer, and why now is there legal action being instituted against the city of Johannesburg?
But Jeremy, I just told you what has been done, and you insist that nothing has been done.
Where exactly are those pictures now? Are they still at the gallery, and are they still in danger?
If you allow me to respond, I can clarify. I'm saying to you that the JAG is a museum of art, and the type of paintings that it houses require to be housed in a building that will be suitable in terms of the museum standards. So it was not prudent for us to move the collection to the buildings that have been previously recommended by the Friends of the Jack because they were quite not suitable for that purpose. And what we have then done was to engage one of the sister institutions, which is Ditsong. And we are now in the process of finalizing the relocation of the collection to Ditsong because we found that the space that Ditsong offered was more in line with the, you know, the conditions under which
right.
the kind of collection that the Jack has.
Thank you for the clarification. So when will these pictures be moved?
So today the Art Gallery Committee is going to sit to consider proposals of how this collection can be moved, because it is not simply just an exercise of taking the artworks. There's a whole lot of administration involved. So all the artworks, we have to complete condition reports, which have been done. We have to then look at the sizes so that we can develop a specification for the transportation and for the packaging of these works, because given the sensitivity of the works,
and I
they
do
need
appreciate
to be packaged.
That. Give me a rough timeline here.
So today we are sitting to consider the proposals, and then we will then present those to the Anglo-American Centenary Trust, who are the ones that are going to be paying for the relocation, given that they have a mandate to support the JAG. And our projection is that, you know, within the next 3 months, we should have been finalizing the relocation of the artworks.
All right, we'll keep a very close eye on it. Thank you very much indeed, Director of Arts and Culture in the City of Johannesburg, Vuyosile Mshudulu.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
All right, let's move on to that other story now as we pivot from art to politics and as we follow the hotly contested American election. Local political commentator Pumlani Majozi believes that African countries shouldn't have to choose sides as there are pressing issues, he says, that no American president will be able to solve. He joins me on the program now. And firstly, then, what is the main thrust of your argument?
Yes, well, I'm arguing that we have already entered what Professor Neil Ferguson, the author and historian, has called Cold War II, right? Where we are already seeing those divisions coming through between the U.S. and China. We can see it playing out with respect to Ukraine-Russia war. We can also see it with respect to the argument on Taiwan. We can also see that in Africa, we are seeing them, you know, we are seeing powers sort of, you know, coming through. We are seeing that new scramble for Africa now, with Russia coming through, trying to, you know, to make an influence. We are seeing China with huge, massive projects is running through in Africa. We are seeing the U.S. as well coming to make an impact in Africa. So I think that for us, let's not get closer to Russia or get closer to China at the expense of our relations with the West. Because in my observation, what we have been doing over the years as Africans is to lean more toward the East and create this hostile sort of relationship with the West. And I don't think that is helpful for us, because we need to be balanced so that you know, we are able to trade with these nations and to address much of the problems that we face as, you know, Africa's peoples.
What do you think, or why do you think, African leaders then continue to support countries like Russia and China, despite, as you're suggesting, a negative impact on occasions on the continent?
Well, it's very easy to answer that, Jeremy. It's because these leaders that you've just mentioned, of the countries you've mentioned, Russia, China, and so on, they give Africans a pass when it comes to the matters of governance, when it comes to the matters of democracy, when it comes to matters of human rights being, you know, being upheld. Those nations, they give African leaders a pass. Whereas Westerners or Western governments or Western nations, they've tended to question human rights in Africa if those human rights are under threat or they are being abused. They have said, listen, we can collaborate with you, but so long as you have human rights abuses taking place, we are going to try and hold it to account. Whereas other leaders of Russia and so on, they've tended to tolerate that and work with dictatorial African leaders, repressive African leaders, despotic African leaders, work with them, continue to transact, and ignore the fact that there could be human rights issues that are taking shape in the African continent. So those are the dynamics we've seen. And therefore, African leaders, they are therefore open and willing and like to work more with countries like Russia and so on. Because why? Because those countries are saying, look, we are fine. We don't care with whatever you do or how you govern. We are just going to work with you and transact.
So it's a relationship then of political expedience or expediency. How do you then convince African leaders to strive for that balance that you're suggesting, if at all you can do that?
Well, that's a tough one, because many of these leaders, they are driven by more of their by their interests than the interests of the people. Now, let's suppose they could hear me if I were to say, let's put the interest of Africans first. What do Africans need, right? They need good governance, right? By good governance, we mean that there is law and order, right? We see many security issues in the African continent. So how do we ensure that there is law and order? How do we pursue pro-business, pro-market, pro-growth policies, creating an environment where there is less regulation on business, where taxes are more, you know, it's taxes that can attract investment from other nations? How do we create a society where basically we see that collaboration amongst the citizens? And so if they were to put the interests of their citizens first and say, look, we do need investment both from the US, the EU, China as well. It's not only that we are just working for our, you know, personal interests. We put the interests of the people first. And if we do that, we are therefore going to work with everybody. Why? Because we want investment to come in. We want to export our goods to the Chinese market, to the EU market, to the US market. All these markets matter for us. And therefore, let's not choose sides. Let's choose, let's be balanced for them to advance the interests of our people so that their well-being is uplifted.
What about the argument that Western foreign policy, whether through military intervention or economic sanctions, often pursues its own geopolitical interests rather than prioritizing African stability and development? So surely we have to be just as cautious about the West.
Well, I mean, look, Jeremy, there is of course much to criticize about the West when it comes to its policy in Africa. But I would also ask that there is much to criticize about any foreign entity that tries to operate in Africa, right? I mean, nations have their interests as well. And when they come into Africa, they will come with some interests. They can be nefarious. That can happen, right? The question is, what are we as Africans doing to ensure that we know we work in a manner that we, that there is that mutual benefit between us and the nations who work with us? So yes, there is that much to criticize with the West in Africa, but I would argue that as much as we can criticize them for that, the question is, how do we, I write in my recent piece that the core focus must be, how do we respect relations with the West? How do we negotiate? How do we start to say, we want to work with you, we presume that you do want to work with us for mutual benefit? How do you reset those relations? Yes, they may have in things that happened in the past, but how do you reset and reach a state where there is a mutual benefit? It begins with the reset, not just say, let's just forsake the relations with the West, which is what Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, with these military junta leaders who have come through via coups. What they've done is to severe relations with the West and therefore get closer to Russia. To me, I don't think that is wise.
Is the better argument not, and I understand that it could be a trope, but African solutions for African problems? In other words, rather than aligning with global powers who might not fully understand African context, rather a continental push for African-led initiatives, maybe through regional organizations like the African Union, or even better economic cooperation within the continent itself. Is that at all feasible?
Well, that's a must. But remember, the argument or the discussion was about how we deal with these foreign nations. When it comes to internal, continental matters of, you know, trade, how do we work with one another to address the issues of security? That is a given. That is a given. We do need that. That is a given, regardless of whether we engage China or US or not. We've got to create collaboration within the SADC, within the East Africa region, within the West Africa region. In Central Africa, there are serious problems going on there. How do we coordinate? And I like this free trade agreement that is being implemented now, the Africa Free Trade Agreement. I think it's good. It's the right step forward. We need such. But that's a given. That is a must. We don't even have to talk about that, you know, because that must be done. We need to fix our own house. We need to ensure that we create an environment where there is, a good economic productivity and growth and institutions work. No doubt about that. That has to be done, for sure.
Pumlani Majozi, thank you very much indeed. It is certainly an interesting and a stimulating debate to have. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, more on a story that we have given some prominence to on the MoneyWeb website. Results for the second sitting of the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants qualifying examinations have not been good. In fact, the worst in the past 6 years, we read. Only 14% of 1,144 candidates who sat for the second sitting of the initial test of competence this year passed, compared to 40% who passed last year, 25% who passed in 2022. For the second examination. The Chief Executive Officer of SAICA is Patricia Stock. We have spoken to her before on the program. Patricia, welcome to you. So what specific factors then have contributed to the sharp decline in the rate?
Good morning, Jeremy, or rather good afternoon to you and your listeners. Jeremy, you know, the sharp decline in the pass rate, it's as a result of quite a number of factors. But before I go to that, I must first express that as SAICA, we definitely acknowledge that this low pass rate that we've seen, it remains a concern, and it requires a fresh thinking around what opportunities arise because of this, so that we need to relook at our programs and find opportunities to do things differently. As SAICA, I'm going to start off with the role of SAICA, because that's very important for the listeners to understand. We are regulated as a member of IFAC, and as part of that, we apply international education standards, which require us as a professional body to specify educational entry requirements, which should enable all our candidates to have a reasonable chance of success, right? And that we should not have excessive barriers of entry in terms of what our candidates undergo. So in terms of the number of factors, as I said, it's quite a number of factors, right? And what we've also seen is that looking at the analysis of the numbers themselves, that the large group of the candidates are coming from, those who are studying via the distant learning mode, which poses different challenges. And I can relate to that, Jeremy, from my own experience. When I finished varsity, started work, you know, when I had to write my second board exam, I didn't make it the first time around. And it's a reality that, you know, to balance your work, the workload and your studies, and some of us coming from the, social background whereby you had to also look at the family responsibilities that you had to meet at the time, you know, those are contributing factors as well. So, and it requires the entire ecosystem as well to look at what are the things that we can enhance to enable our candidates to have a better chance of success.
All right, let's talk about the fresh thinking that you need in just a moment. But before we do that, though, the long-term implications of such poor pass rates, not only for the accountancy profession in South Africa, but Patricia Stock, I would also suggest to you that this has a real impact on the economy itself. What are those implications?
Yeah, look, what it means for us, it obviously have an impact directly on the pipeline, with respect to, you know, the number of CAs that we want to produce to save our economy. However, Jeremy, I must also emphasize that on the topic of access, right, SAICA, we do have more than one designation, you know, just to ensure that, especially focusing on ensuring that we have sufficiently skilled accountants, you know, serving in the accountancy profession. It's very key for us. So we do have AGA. So even candidates that didn't make it, it doesn't mean that it's an end for them. So there's different pathways in which they can follow into the future as well. And the AGA is one of the pathways, which also has got great stature, because the candidates also go through the same program in terms of the technical training that they undergo with training firms. They acquire the
Patricia,
same kind of
Patricia, I understand competency. That, but being a chartered accountant is the holy grail.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, being a chartered accountant is our highest designation, but I also want to emphasize that it's not the end of the journey for our candidates, because we've got various pathways. But look, Clearly, we do have a challenge, Jeremy. As I said, it affects the pipeline, in terms of what we need for our country. However, it's an area that we're definitely focusing on, to ensure that we do have enough supply for our economy in the long term.
So you talked about the fresh thinking and guaranteeing that supply. What exactly are you doing? What immediate steps is SAICA able to take to prevent a further deterioration in future examination results?
So our focus is it's a stakeholder approach in terms of what we need to do, and the interventions that we're going to implement requires us to look at the entire ecosystem. Firstly, looking at the student, the candidate themselves, and then looking at the employer, looking at our academic providers, and also our processes, especially around our monitoring processes. So those are the things that we're looking at currently, just so that we can look at what didn't work. Or what's not working with respect to, the contributing factors to the numbers that we're seeing, especially with the distance learning programs, Jeremy, because that's where we are seeing the greatest numbers of the learners that didn't make it are coming from that area. And why I'm emphasizing that you also elevated in your opening remarks that, the numbers are significantly worse than the prior years. But when you look at the first timers, right, there is actually a homogeneous trend with respect to the historic pass rate that we are seeing that was ranging around 70% plus range in the previous years, except for when we look at 2023, that's where we had the highest pass rate of 92% for the first timers. However, other years are more or less, in those ranges of the
All right,
70%.
Patricia,
So it
let's
means that
focus let's
more
focus
work
on
needs to be
three let's
done for
focus on
repeaters.
let's focus on three specific areas. You talk about candidates, you talk about employers, and you talk about education providers. Let me suggest to you that you're drawing the wrong candidates, that the accounting firms themselves are perhaps failing in their responsibility, and that accountancy itself is not being taught correctly at universities. Do I have that right?
No, that's not right, Jeremy. I'm not sure what informs that view. In the whole ecosystem, we cannot leave out the employer for sure, and especially when we talk about repeat candidates, because that means that they are working and they need to be given enough time off to be able to prepare for the examination. So the role of an employer is very, very critical, right, in terms of this particular exam, ITC. And when we talk about APC, it also speaks to the work exposure, which is the conversation that we had in our previous chat the last time. So when it comes to university, and hence, I started off by talking to the role of SAICA in terms of ensuring that reasonable access and reasonable chance of success. So every candidate that comes through actually technically should have that reasonable chance of success, right? So for us, it's also to ensure that, looking at the as part of our monitoring process, which universities where we've got the highest number of lower pass rate, whether it's a percentage or number in terms of the actual numbers, and we're going to have directed interventions at looking at what needs to be improved in those universities, and also the wraparound support that needs to be given to the learners, because we need to understand the profile of the learners themselves to realize what are the kind of other support that we need to give them in addition to just academic support. And that speaks to other programs that we do, such as Tutuka. So the models in terms of what we can do to support our learners are there. It's for us to really look at how do we scale it up, with other universities that we might not be offering the same. But look, all of this requires capital in terms of financial support. And we're grateful for organizations that have come forward, like Facet, that has been supporting us in this journey, in terms of interventions that we can actually implement, especially for the repeat candidates.
Are there
So it requires a whole ecosystem.
specific adjustments that are being considered to the exam format itself?
Oh yes, in fact, and I'm glad you're asking that question. So we are moving from ITC to what we call IAC, Initial Assessment of Competency. So there we've actually adjusting things like the time that is given for a candidate. Instead of writing, we're extending the period of days which the candidate will be writing, so that a learner or rather a candidate, they're given a better chance as well of success. So we've been addressing this over a period of time, because I mean every process always has a room for improvement. So it's a process that has been ongoing. So there's quite a couple of new things that we'll be introducing in the next cycle, Jeremy.
But having said that there are no plans, of course, to make things easier.
Oh, no, absolutely not. We cannot. One thing we cannot compromise is the quality of our programs. That's an area that, as much as we want to see the growth in terms of the number of chartered accountants, AGAs, the one area we cannot compromise is quality. So there's definitely no compromise, Jeremy.
And
as I said, we abide and comply with international standards of education. So we have to ensure that we keep our standards at the level that is acceptable at globally as well.
Well, that is gratifying to hear. And germane to all of this, of course, Patricia Stock, is that SAICA also has to have a plan to address the gap in mathematics proficiency, surely at the basic education level. Are you able to get involved in that respect?
Yes, and we are involved, Jeremy, because we have to be part of the solution. So we've got programs that we do together with the department, basic education level. We, as part of the ecosystem, I mean, we do programs with the South African Maths Foundation. But key thing, Jeremy, you know, our programs, initiatives that are targeted at like looking at the whole value chain, but and also the level of influence we can have with the department as well, especially to increase the level of uptake for straight maths. Because if we don't have enough learners taking straight maths, it means that our pipeline will diminish over time. So that's a different area of investment that we are focused on, SAICA together with our other stakeholders. Yeah.
Patricia Stock is the Chief Executive Officer of the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants. Thank you very much for joining me today. And that's also our program for this Thursday. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.